The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you doing?
Boker Tov. Yeah, I was having a look at the story about Tzipi Chotoveli, who is the Israeli ambassador to the UK. A controversial pick from the outset, to be honest. One of former Prime Minister Netanyahu's inner circle was appointed to the UK. And actually, when the new government took office, it is reported that Yair Lapid, current foreign minister, actually tried to replace her. And he was unable to do so because she has a 3-year term that she signed up to and that obviously was signed up to by the government. And she refused to give up her post. And the latest story with her is something that happened yesterday at the London School of Economics. She went to an event there, apparently participating in some sort of a debate forum. There were many pro-Palestinian groups, demonstrators, around making things very, very uncomfortable for her. Ultimately, apparently, she had to be ushered from the location by her security detail and sent off to her car in order to protect her. But as I say, very, very controversial and certainly not unanimously supported by the UK Jewish community, many of whom thought that she was in an inappropriate pick, don't support her, her positions, the things that she's done in the past and what she stands for. Do you guys think that we need to take note of the local Jewish community when appointing an Israeli ambassador to countries around the world? Do you think that's an important consideration?
It's an interesting one, because when former ambassador Arthur Lenk came to South Africa, I met him on the first Friday night that he was here. We had dinner with him and we got into this argument because I asked him how he was going to reach out to community, and he made it very clear that, in fact, he wasn't here for community. He said, I'm not here to represent Jews. I'm here to represent Israel and my relationship with the Jewish community. In effect, what he was saying was way, way down his list of priorities. And I said to him, I will tell you right now, this is our first meeting, that you're making a mistake. That if you think you can divide Israel, separate Israel's support from the Jewish community, then you've fallen into the trap that many have tried to trap us in. You cannot separate it. And I think you're making a mistake. And in fact, we had a very good relationship throughout his time here and continue to have one. And at the end of it, he wasn't somebody who easily acknowledged that he made a mistake. But when we had lost our final discussion before he left, he remembered that discussion, and he said that in fact he was wrong, especially here in South Africa. Our link to Israel, the Jewish community's link to Israel, cannot be separated at all. I guess it's a long way of saying that, yes, I do think the community is important. Whether they should be part of the choice, probably not. I think that would be a very poor decision, because I think you'd never choose anybody. But I do think that relationship is an important one. 34519. Yeah, sorry.
It goes a little bit further than that, because also, you know, there are certain communities which are not as unified as the South African community with regard to their position on Israel. And the UK Jewish community is a good example. There are many, many people who feel, you know, very critical of Israel within the Jewish community. And so the question is, to what extent does the Israeli ambassador have a relationship with those people? You know, they are Jews, but they are not supporters of Israel, or certainly not supporters of many of the things that Israel does. So in many cases, the community is quite divided. The USA is another good example, where you have so many different sectors within the community. Who do you really draw a relationship with? Is it with everybody, strokes for folks, and trying to adapt your approach to the different communities? How does the Israeli ambassador deal with that situation?
It is, of course, a very, I wouldn't say apt, but telling that on the eve of Kristallnacht, that the Israeli ambassador is precluded from having a discussion at the London at the London School of Economics. It really does make one wonder, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that everybody has the right to protest. I think that certainly they have the right to have a say, whether they be Jewish or non-Jewish, pro-Palestinian, whatever people have a right to say. But you know, I think we had this discussion about where your right to protest begins and ends. And, you know, when the ambassador is forced to be ushered from the location for fear of her personal safety, I think there's a certain boundary that's been crossed.
Absolutely right. The United Nations has voted to bring a number of resolutions before the General Assembly that will reinforce the right of Palestinian refugees to claim property and live in Israel. What is the significance of these resolutions?
Howard, I'm exasperated by this whole circus, to be honest. And I don't know whether I should be exasperated because of the fact that there are so many countries that supported this and voted in favor of this or chose to abstain in order not to derail it, including the likes of the United States and the European Union, or whether I should just be exasperated that the United Nations is even discussing things like this at all, because I don't know where this is taking us exactly. I don't know where, how this is progressing the debate, the international debate on the issue of the Palestinian refugees. I don't know any other group of refugees, and perhaps listeners out there might correct me and they know better, but I don't know another group of refugees who have remained refugees for close on 80 years who have been residing elsewhere, who have not been allowed to take up citizenship or to take up natural residency in those locations, who have been kept on the national, international stage in order to make a political statement. Refugees get absorbed. Every European country knows about this. Refugees have come from all places and they've been absorbed. They've been given local citizenship and they've been allowed to get on with their lives as locals, in order to allow them to move on. And yet we've got this issue of the so-called Palestinian refugees, which, is taken care of by the United Nations Refugee Association, which brought the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, that's the official name of this organization looking after the refugees. 5.7 million refugees currently living in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, some of them even in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority area, some of them even in East Jerusalem consider themselves to be refugees. I don't know that this is really taking us anywhere. And I'm not sure what the answer is, except for the fact that I think that every place where these people are living should be obliged to absorb them, to give them citizenship, to allow them to have health care and education and a job, pay their taxes and live their lives, and not 80 years later still be feeding their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren into this whole refugee status. It's just something which I don't get.
It's phenomenal. And I always think back to my late grandmother who left Germany as a youngster, lost her entire family. But if you had told her that she was a refugee, I would have got a short, sharp smack to the back of my head, because her identity wasn't that. And very, very right. quickly, she built a life and carried on. And it's just bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, the fact that the United Nations is occupying themselves, first of all, through the committees, all of these resolutions that have been passed that reaffirm the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to places in sovereign Israel, or for the receipt of compensation for property that they lost when they fled their homes. There's just a whole raft of these resolutions, one of which was passed by 160-1, with Israel being the only vote against, and there were 9 countries that abstained. So this was the one resolution which is considered to be the most benign out of the whole raft that was passed at the committee stage, I should add, at this, and not by the General Assembly. This is due to come before the General Assembly in due course later this year. But it's just occupying time and energy and masses of money through the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and also through the General Assembly and the machinations of the United Nations. I don't know whether this was what the United Nations was really set up to do. I think they should be working just to house those people where they are and just allow them to be absorbed in their local communities, and let's try and move on. Because, I mean, we could go through this whole argument about what happened to the refugees from Arab countries that Israel was forced to absorb, all of those Middle Eastern Jews who were excluded from countries when Israel was set up, and the property that they lost and the status that they, I mean, we've forgotten about that already. Those people today are Israeli citizens, their children and their grandchildren are Israeli. I mean, they haven't forgotten about where they came from, but they are certainly not Israelis, refugees, and we've just somehow need to move on.
Absolutely no question about that. Israeli police have succeeded in breaking a large arms supply ring.
Yeah, so this really is a story that follows, I suppose, all of those violent deaths that have been occurring within Israel's Arab sector. And the police have been working to try to stem the supply of illegal arms and ammunition through the criminal sector within Israel, focusing very much on the Arab sector. And apparently they managed to get cooperation from somebody who was considered formally to be a part of the criminal organization, and who decided to effectively become a state witness, for want of a better term, and started to cooperate with the police, and worked with them by buying weapons through many of these illegal weapons, arms smuggling gangs. And in the end, they managed to arrest a whole host of people in order to try to stop this illegal supply of arms and ammunition. Apparently, as part of the operation, the police have seized 40 rifles and 13 pistons, 2 machine guns, explosives linked to cell phones, and apparently something like 65 people have been arrested, including a father and 3 of his sons who operated a family arms dealing business. And apparently this took up the time and attention of up to 1,000 police, who included special forces and also the border police, while trying to stem this flow of illegal arms. So I think that this is just one area that needs to be addressed when we look at the more than 100 people who have been killed now within the Arab sector, criminal related killings, people related to gangs, to family warfare, to family feuds. And so the idea is to try somehow to stop all of this from happening. One angle is to stop the flow of illegal arms and ammunition, but I don't think that that's the end of the story. I think there's still a lot to do within the Arab sector to somehow stop this whole cycle of killing and then killing as part of a revenge, and then it just continues to circulate without any stop. So this apparently is the largest capture of illegal arms and ammunition that's ever been done in Israel since the inception of the State of Israel by the Israeli police.